Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Marty Epstein, composer, pianist, and devoted teacher. She plays prepared piano with the guitarist David Tronzo in the Epstein-Tronzo duo. She is professor of composition at Berklee College of Music and is on the faculty of Boston Conservatory. On Friday, March 4th, the Worcester Chamber Music Society will present her Lazy Susan as part of that evening's program with Joshua Gordon on cello and Randall Hodgkinson on piano. Marty, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise.
Now, the piece that's going to be presented from the Worcester Chamber Music Society on March 4th is called Lazy Susan. And this brings up a whole thing I have to ask you about. But talk to me about Lazy Susan. When was it written?
It was written in 1997, and it was written for two young students at the Rivers Music School, now called the Rivers Conservatory in Weston. And every year they have a new music festival that they call the Seminar on Contemporary Music for the Young. And every year I wrote pieces for some of the students to play. And this piece was written for two of my music theory students, Eliza Jaques, who's now Eliza Meyer, and she's a professional cellist, and Jessica Tan, who I lost track of her. I don't know where she is, but she's the pianist. And, you know, obviously, they're not playing in any recordings that anyone would hear, but they played it beautifully. They played it as well as any professionals have played it. But the title, should I talk about the title?
Oh, always. Always talk about your titles.
Okay. So the title, this is kind of a mundane inspiration, but I often in my music have kind of it's almost like a parade of ideas that change throughout the course of a piece. And I happened to be at a Chinese restaurant, and I was noticing how all the dishes remained in the same place and remained the same dishes as they went around throughout the course of the meal, but they became changed because people were, you know, taking food off the plates, and they were becoming diminished. And finally we got back around to the beginning, and it was just like a few little tiny scraps from the way it had been at the beginning. And I find musical inspiration in all places, even the most mundane experience of eating very delicious Chinese food and watching the food disappear off the plates. And so that's why the piece is called Lazy Susan, because that's what happens in the piece.
That was a great explanation. I actually love that. Now, this brings up several questions.
Okay, good.
One of them is writing for your students.
Yeah.
As a professor.
Yeah.
Are you purposely writing pieces that are going to challenge them?
Yeah, and I haven't written for students in a long time because I don't really teach young students anymore. But when I was teaching younger students, when I was teaching at Rivers, my goal in writing for them is, or I should say was, to write music that was as artistically and intellectually as challenging as anything I would write for an adult, because it turns out kids have just as much artistic sophistication as adults do. That's what I learned from teaching kids. And the worst thing you can do is, if you're writing for kids, even very young kids, is to write sort of, you know, silly, quirky, cutesy music. They know that you're doing, they hate that, actually. And so I have a collection of piano etudes called American Etudes that are actually going to be performed at Boston Conservatory in April. And they're 12 actually pretty difficult etudes that I wrote for kids between the ages of 9 and 14. And, you know, you have to take the technical capabilities of the students into consideration. So some of them are extremely technically easy, but they all have challenges in terms of patience and focus, things that my music is known for, I guess. I think that you can be as artistically and intellectually as complicated as you want when you're writing for kids, as long as you take their technical capabilities into consideration.
But I was just thinking about how the students feel playing a piece by their professor, written for them. That is, it's like the most challenging kind of final exam.
Yeah, but they loved it, you know. And
oh, you think they loved it? They were sweating bullets, I'm sure.
They might have been, but you know, and some of the students I wrote for weren't my students, because I was asked to write some of these piano pieces after I left Rivers. And so some of the students I wrote for didn't really know me, but I got to know them because I coached them. That's actually an important part of the answer to your question, because I never just gave the students the music and then went away and hoped for the best. I coached them. You know, their teachers asked me to come in and coach them, and I forged a relationship with them. And so that it was less of, oh my God, this scary composer is looking down on me. And it was more of a collaborative relationship with the kids. And that turned out really, really well, I think.
When you, as a composer, how often do you actually get the chance to check up when some other organization or group are playing your pieces? I mean, do you make it a habit to do that? Or is it one of those things, I've written it, I've sent it out there, and whatever they do with it, it's their business?
You know, it really depends on who the organization is.
Okay.
I do that less and less, because more and more people who play my music already know what some of the, I was going to say pitfalls, but that's a negative thing. I don't really mean that. But what some of the parameters are in playing my music. But if it was a group that I had never worked with before, I might ask to come to, you know, maybe like the second to the last rehearsal, just to check in and make sure. Now, I had kind of an upsetting experience recently, and I'm not going to say who the group was, but there was a group that was playing a piece of mine, and they had not played my music before. And they said, oh, we're going to be fine. You don't need to rehearsal. And I went to the performance, and it was actually, I think it was my first performance post, I mean, we're not post-COVID, but, you know, it was like my first live.
The denouement of COVID.
Exactly, which is lasting a long time. But but it was really terrible. The pianist just completely ignored most of the things in the score, including, you know, I often ask pianists to leave the pedal down for the duration of the piece, because my music depends a lot on the resonance of the instrument in addition to the actual notes that I write. And,
right.
And they just kept lifting the pedal up and completely destroying what the effect of the piece was. So that's when I was reinforced in my own mind that if it's a group of people who have not played my music before or who I don't know, I will ask to come. So
was that a red flag, by the way, as soon as they said, yeah, we got it, don't worry about it?
In retrospect, huge red flag.
Yeah, that definitely. Now, when that and I'm sure that only happens rarely.
Right.
But when it does happen, what do you do? I mean, do you go up them afterwards and go, hey?
Well, you know, one thing I teach my composition students, or I try to teach them, is that no matter what happens in the performance, you have to be gracious to the performers. Huh. So that's the first thing. I went up and I thanked them. And one of the performers was great. I mean, she played really well. But the pianist, I said, you know, thank you so much for playing my piece. You should know that, first of all, the lid of the piano needs to be up. And second of all, when a composer says put the pedal down the whole time, they actually really mean that. And third of all, if you had any questions, I'm a living composer. I'm easily accessible. You could have contacted me. And he actually wanted to argue with me. He said, well, the dynamic is 4 P's for a lot of the piece. And I said, but that doesn't mean put the lid down.
Wait a minute. So he's arguing with the composer?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little bit of like post-adolescent hubris. If you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. It's like, oh my God.
So, you know, hopefully he'll, you know, I don't know this person. He's a very young young performer just like trying to forge his way in the new music world. And he'll hear this from more people than just me. So I hope that I'm the first little seed that gets planted in his head and that he'll hear it again and that he'll become, you know, more attentive to the score, whether it's Chopin or me. Because in fact,
well, it's not his piece he's playing.
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, if I could just say one more thing about that, if you are playing Chopin, which pianists, you know, in conservatories love to do, and Chopin was a great composer, but people don't, young pianists don't pay attention to everything Chopin puts in the score either. He's extremely meticulous with his pedal markings and with his phrasing and with his tempo markings and when you should be rubato and when you should speed up and when you should slow down. And performances of Chopin suffer because people aren't paying attention to his score either. So there needs to be an attention to the details that a composer puts in the score, whether it's, you know, in the 19th century or now and everything in between, I would say.
Now, before we go any further, I'm going to ask you, and you address this on your website, too, that people often ask you, how would you describe the kinds of music that you compose? And on your website, you said that the music was quiet, delicate, or slow-paced is what you said.
Slow-paced, yeah.
And I found it different. I found it delicate and perhaps quiet in pieces, but I thought it was very intricate.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting comment because it's extremely intricate in my concept of the piece.
Right.
It's extremely intricate in my brain. But then the overarching sound world, I think that slow-paced and quiet don't preclude being intricate.
No, they don't. No, they don't. No, they don't.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree with you, basically.
You want your music to be listened to carefully.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's really an interesting thing to do. So you're going to, the way your work, when I experience it, is I have to keep my mind awake. It's not stuff that's being put in the background while I do dishes.
Precisely.
Although, I mean, it could, I guess. But I have no idea, this is not, every one of your pieces to me is like a new sort of poem. And
thank you.
And I got to understand where it's going and what's happening.
Exactly. Every piece I've written, even so the piece that the Lazy Susan piece was written, as I said, in 1997. And I think that my music isn't quite as sophisticated as it is now, maybe. But every piece I have written basically has a process that plays out throughout the course of the piece, whether it's a 5-minute piece or a 50-minute piece, 5-0. But I had two really interesting comments, one from my son and one from my mother, so neither of whom are professional musicians. And my son, when he was very small, came to a performance of Hypnagogia, which I think you listened to.
That's out on a recording, I should mention.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I told him, you know, the piece is really long, and if you can, just try to sit quietly. And afterwards he said, you know, Mom, I don't know if I like your music, but I realized that it's good to daydream by. And I had a good time listening to your piece because I was daydreaming. And that is completely fine with me because that means there's something in the music that's stimulating some part of your brain. So
that's right.
Fine.
It's resonating with different things.
Exactly. And then my mother, who's not only not a trained musician, my father is, by the way, but my mother is, you know, I don't know how she really hears music because she's a little bit tone deaf, and she wouldn't mind me saying that because, you know, it's like a family, part of family lore. But she said she realized that if she, sort of the opposite response that my son had, she said if she just sort of quiets her brain and just listens to what's happening, then the piece is actually really enjoyable to listen to. So I thought that was fascinating to hear two people who aren't professional musicians may have thought that what they were listening to was not entertaining or whatever, and they both came at a way to listen to the music and to appreciate it. So I thought that was fascinating, the comments.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Marty Epstein, composer, pianist, devoted teacher. She plays prepared piano with guitarist David Tronzo in the Epstein-Tronzo duo. She is professor of composition at Berklee College of Music and is on the faculty of Boston Conservatory. On Friday, March 4th, the Worcester Chamber Music Society will present her Lazy Susan as part of the evening's program with Joshua Gordon, cello, and Randall Hodgkinson, piano. Marty, I got to talk to you about the titling of your pieces.
Okay.
Because that just sets me off on a weird tangent listening to your music. And then some of your titles I just found like sort of delightful. I don't know how to explain it. Like The World is Our Tiny Oyster.
Can I explain about that one?
Well, you don't feel like you have to explain everything, but what happens to the person who's listening, who's reading that, is your mind starts reeling off a tale, a story, or multiple stories. But go ahead. Tell me about your tiny oyster.
Well, so that piece has special significance because I wrote that piece, I think, in April 2020, April 2020.
That's right.
We had just locked down. I and all of my dear musician friends were a profound state of panic, despair, the things. And my friend Lilith Hartunian, who's an amazing violinist, you know, she and I were staying in communication with each other. We were FaceTiming. We were, you know, really trying to stay connected to each other. And she's a violinist, but she had just bought a toy piano. And she said, why don't you write a piece for us to play? And I'll, you know, you video your part, I'll video my part. And she was learning how to use iMovie. And she said she'd put it together in a little video. And then I was sort of looking through her old Facebook posts, and she had talked about, I actually think she reposted this, about a trip she and her husband took to Italy, and she said, remember when the world was our oyster? And so I believe the title is The Sky is Our Tiny Oyster, or maybe I changed it to The World is Our Tiny Oyster. Anyway, I was referencing her nostalgia for when we could go on trips. And I was I also wrote that piece out of deep love for her and our friendship. And the piece is extremely short. I think it's about 2.5 minutes long. We posted it on Instagram. And I don't know if we'll ever perform it live, but it was written expressly for this bizarre situation we found ourselves in. So
your pieces have this kind of a tale?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I love that.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Then I have to ask you about this one. I have so many other questions to ask you.
Oh, good.
The Secrets of Dissolved Transitions.
Oh, so that piece was also written for Lilith. That piece is, so Lilith and a pianist composer she plays with, Ryan Vigil, asked me for this piece. So there's also a deep connection with Ryan Vigil because this is circling back to something we just talked about. Ryan is now, I think, in his early 40s, late 30s, early 40s, professional musician. He was my very first student at the Rivers Music School.
Wow.
And he is the person I wrote the very first American Etude for. So fast forward, he and Lilith play chamber music together, and they asked me to write a long piece for violin and piano for them. And I think that piece is like around 47 to 50 minutes long. And I had an imagination of what I wanted to do in the piece. And I was at Math MoCA, and they have an exhibit of James Turrell. I don't know.
Yes.
So there's this piece of his. I don't remember the title of the piece, but it's this panel. And you sit in a room and you watch this panel, and you realize it has changed without knowing that it is changing. The lights are changing. So like all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait, this looks different than it did a minute ago. But you're not aware of the change. So I looked up what that's called, and It's called dissolved transition. It's something that filmmakers use too, where the scene just sort of dissolves from one thing to the next thing without the viewer being aware that the dissolving has happened. So that's exactly what my piece is about. And so that's why I called it that.
You've also written pieces for large numbers of performers. And I just want to check this out. Blinding Vapors of Foam and White.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so that's a title that comes from Moby Dick. Moby Dick is my most favorite book of all time, and a lot of my titles are sentences that come from that book. I find
that's
that
really
Melville,
fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, he has the most, he's one of the most beautiful, in my humble opinion, one of the most beautiful writers in the English language.
Well, it's a very weird book.
It's a very weird book, and weird, and it's messy, and it's slow in spots, and
It starts out as sort of a whale story, and then about halfway through the book, it goes completely mystical.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he doesn't write another book until he's almost dead.
Exactly, because how could you follow that, you know?
I know, it's a tough act to follow.
But that particular piece was...
That's for 53 performers?
Yeah, and it was to be performed outside. It was performed on the Esplanade. And interestingly, I couldn't be there at the performance because this is something that never happens to me, but I had four performances in four different cities that day. And I was in New York because I was part of a festival of music by Anton Webern and myself that Trinity Wall Street performed. But I had a performance in Leipzig that day. I had two performances in Boston that day. So I never heard that piece because you can't really hear... It's not really possible to hear a comprehensive recording. It's kind of a one-off piece. I don't know. I can't imagine it being performed again unless that same group performed it. So, that was a very strange experience.
That's
actually.
It's interesting because in your artist statement on your website, you talk about where you grew up. You grew up in Nebraska and Colorado, which is, when I think about both of those states, and I've been to Colorado, I haven't been to Nebraska, but it's a huge sky.
Huge.
And people can't understand it here in New England. If you've never been out to the western, especially the prairies, the sky is like this thing.
And people don't understand that it's beautiful, you know.
Right.
If you've been to Colorado, that means you've either, I don't know if you flew or drove, but that means you either flew over Nebraska or you drove through Nebraska.
I flew over Nebraska.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can even, you're probably still too high to really, to really get the feel of it at that point. But
well, it's just flat.
It's flat, but the beauty of it is the things that you can see. And the sky is incredible because all kinds of things happen in the sky that we don't necessarily see or pay attention to. I find it mystical. I find it spiritual. I get deeply offended when people say, oh my God, I drove across Interstate 80, and it was the most boring 8 hours of my life. And
hey, it's where Dorothy lived, right? No, she lived in Kansas.
She lived in Kansas, yeah. But
it was next door.
It's absolutely, and Kansas is even flatter than Nebraska, because Nebraska has bluffs on the Missouri River on the east side, and in the west it's flat, but it's gradually, very gradually inclining because the elevation gets very, very gradually higher and higher until you get into Denver, so, or into Wyoming, depending on which direction you're going.
What I love about your artist statement is that you talked about how you originally drew and painted, but then you felt you weren't that good at it, and you finally found composing as the artistic sort of outlet for your expression. Do you still draw and paint?
Oh, that is such a good question, because I haven't done it in a while. I have a bunch of paintings on my wall, and some friends of mine have paintings of mine that I framed for them and they have displayed. I haven't done it in about, I don't know, 10 years.
Yep,
and
yep.
I'm reading a book right now about the female painters in the 40s in New York. Elaine de Kooning and Lee Krasner and Helen Frankenthaler. And I'm getting the urge to at least get out some pencils and start drawing again. So
just out of my own curiosity, what kind of work did you do?
Oh, it's like, it's completely, first of all, it's watercolor, almost entirely watercolor.
Okay.
And second of all, it's completely abstract. Like,
Why am I not surprised?
I have no representational artist skill at all.
Well, it's not necessarily if you have the skill, because you could probably learn some of that. It's the impulse. What you want to put down, and that makes total sense listening to your compositions.
And it's very colorful. I'm really interested in, you know, exploring the limits of what I can do color wise. But one thing I tell my students who don't want to learn music theory or counterpoint or any of those things is that one of the reasons why I stopped painting is because I felt like I was limited by my lack of technique,
right,
and my lack of representational skill. There's a picture at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which is six or nine frames. It's by Picasso. And the first one is a very accurate representational drawing of a buffalo. And each subsequent frame is more and more abstract, so that by the time you get to the last one, it's just a series of lines. And that's the best lesson of how you can't really be a great abstract artist until you develop that craft, the skill, the eye, you know, how you can translate what you're seeing onto the paper, I think. So I tell my students about that.
I think you're right. I think you have to know what you're taking away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what to leave behind.
Yeah, exactly.
But you have to know what's there.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Do you continually write? Is there a certain time of the day? Is there a process in your writing? We only have a minute or two left. When I talk to poets, when I talk to other kinds of artists, you know, they might have a work schedule by which I'm going to sit down and I'm going to try to compose. Is that, can you do that? Or is it one of those things you need an inspiration?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because I think, you know, since I started composing when I was 17, I think that I have constantly had a part of my brain pointed towards the act of composing. I think that whether it's conscious, unconscious, subconscious, whatever, I'm always thinking about it, because I think that's why I can, you know, go to a Chinese restaurant and think
make,
about
also
music.
We're completely out of time, and I'm sorry, because I have three other pages of questions to ask. My guest tonight has been Marty Epstein, composer, pianist, devoted teacher. She plays prepared piano with guitarist David Tronzo in the Epstein-Tronzo duo. She is professor of composition at Berklee College of Music. She's on the faculty of Boston Conservatory. And on Friday, March 4th, the Worcester Chamber Music Society will present her piece, Lazy Susan, as part of that evening's program with Joshua Gordon, cello, and Randall Hodgkinson, piano. Marty, I hope to have you back sometime.
I would love to come back. Great conversation.
I know. I loved it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.